do you produce political change in Russia? I always tell them it is a process that takes 9 months and then 21 years. And Russia's in the middle of that process right now. It's what happens in the meantime, while we wait for this new generation, that is worrisome. Earlier, I compared companies and countries, and there is a lot to that comparison. But there is one way in which countries will never be like companies. Companies can rise, fail, fall, and disappear. Countries can rise, fail, and fall, but they rarely disappear. Instead, they stick around as failed states. Imagine if IBM went bankrupt, but was still out in the marketplace with all its unpaid salespeople and managers selling computer parts on the black market, trying to cheat old customers and trying to prove their continued relevance by throwing wrenches into whatever their old competitors were doing. One reason that the pre-1914 era of globalization collapsed into World War I was the fact that the Austro-Hungarian Empire, one of the principal players of the European balance of power system in that day, experienced a long, slow erosion of power that gained momentum between 1909 and 1914. The Austro-Hungarian Empire understood that it was falling out of the great power race economically, militarily, and politically. Instead of suffering this humiliation quietly, it behaved like the gunslinger who finds himself in a poker game he can't win. He kicks over the table and starts shooting. In the case of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it aligned itself with Germany to eliminate Serbia in a local war, knowing this would likely trigger a world war with Russia. When Serbia, Albania, and Algeria act up, it can be messy, but it won't threaten the system as a whole. But what we don't know is what happens if and when large states like a Russia, a Japan, or a China fail at globalization but still have military power from the old system. As political scientist Robert A. Pastor observed in his book, A Century's Journey, How the Great Powers Shaped the World, the challenge faced by the globalization system after the Cold War was really very similar to the challenge faced by the Versailles system after World War I. How do we integrate the losers into the winners' system? The Peace of Versailles did a very poor job of integrating the losers and was resented by them, so much so that it sowed the seeds for World War II. The peace following World War II did a good job of integrating the biggest losers, Germany and Japan, and that helped to stabilize both Europe and Asia. In the case of the post-Cold War world, the question is, how do we integrate the losers from the Cold War into a market-oriented globalization system composed of mostly democratic states? This is particularly difficult, notes Pastor, because the post-Cold War peace is different from the Versailles peace in that the victory of the Western Allies was not unconditional in the Cold War. The West did not occupy Russia or China or Vietnam, and therefore its ability to influence and shape the internal politics of the Cold War losers was limited and greatly varied from country to country. Yet the system has a huge stake in the successful integration of countries such as Russia and China. The key ingredient for any stable international system, says Pastor, is that the principal challengers believe they have more at stake in preserving the system than in toppling it. For now, that could still be said of Russia and China when it comes to the globalization system. But what if it turns out to be just too damn hard for them or others? Will countries that can't make microchips make trouble instead? This isn't just an issue for developing countries or the unskilled. It also applies to those who can make microchips. There is a sister issue to just too hard that increasingly comes up with people today, and that is the problem of just too fast. The pace of change in this globalization system is now so fast and the requirements for success so constantly evolving that no one ever feels they are on solid ground in the way their parents at least seemed to feel in the world of walls, when a union card or a lifetime career with the same company seemed to guarantee stability in one's life. After the first edition of this book came out, I received a touching letter from a woman from Roanoke, Illinois, that eloquently expressed a concern I often hear from people, but for which I have no easy answer. What happens if the speed of change demanded by this new system is more than individuals, companies, or countries can handle? The letter read as follows. Dear Mr. Friedman, I hope this letter finds you, and I hope you can solve a mystery for me. I have seen you on several talk shows and was impressed enough to buy your book. I have read the book several times, but have not found the answer to my question. Where do I fit in to today's market? My husband and I have always been self-employed without success. In 1984, I found my way into college, where I hungrily ate every course I could afford, including computers, economics, stocks, business, and accounting. The local economy was in deep recession, since what is bad for Caterpillar is bad for everyone. The work I found went nowhere, and I finally retired. In the meantime, my husband had started selling homegrown computers and was making money for the first time. With the advent of computers under $1,000, his winning streak is coming to an end. We know all the essential elements of business, including the internet and computers, but we do not see our place in the global market. We know how to sell, but we do not know what to sell. For example, I have all the tools to write the great American novel, but lack the talent. When the millionaires planted their seeds in the stock market, we were broke. Where does the little guy fit into this great world market? We are not alone in this quandary. We have many friends sitting on the same fence, wondering what happened to us and where we should go next. Perhaps you could address this issue in your next personal appearance. I wish I had a simple answer. It seems that a day doesn't go by anymore without some article in the newspaper warning workers and their bosses to downsize, learn new skills, cut old ties, web up, become faster, become more flexible, become more prepared to throw out the old and the new, and bring in the even newer and get with the program. The only problem is, the program seems to change every 6 months, and that is just too fast and too hard for many educated people, let alone the uneducated. How will people start to react if they find this system just too damn hard and too damn fast for too damn long? Just too connected. Another way in which globalization can threaten globalization is when the system itself gets so greased and wires the world so tightly together that small groups of people, whether it be investors or super-empowered angry men, can threaten the whole edifice by their excesses. If you talk to Wall Street investment banks today, they will tell you that the thing that absolutely took them by surprise in the market meltdown of August-September 1998 was how much more interconnected the system was than they realized. None of their risk models, which were based on past correlations between investments and certain events, had anticipated the sort of chain reactions that in 1998 made a mockery of the whole concept of diversification. Companies that thought they were diversified by investing in different financial instruments with different maturities, in different currencies, in different markets, in different countries, found out quickly that all their investments were part of one big interlinked chain from which they could not escape when markets started to nosedive. One link in the chain pulled down the other. Thanks to globalization, this chain is becoming longer and longer, tighter and tighter every day, and the scary truth is we still don't fully understand what it means to be so interlinked, or how to protect ourselves when one of those links weakens. This interconnectedness applies not only to financial markets, but was also graphically on display with the Y2K millennium bug, which was created when computers were built with internal clocks and, in order to save memory space, rendered dates with just 6 digits. 2 for the day, 2 for the month, and, you guessed it, 2 for the year. That meant they only went up to 12/31/99. So when the calendar hit January 1st, 2000, many older computers registered that not as 01/01/2000, but as 01/01/00. And they thought it was 1900 all over again. Fortunately, good advance preparations and purchases of new computers by countries and companies rendered the Y2K threat pretty harmless by the time the millennium rolled around. New Year's 2000, rather than being a global nightmare that united us all in fear, turned into a global party that united us all in celebration. Now that we have survived Y2K, though, it doesn't mean that all our overconnectedness problems are behind us. Think about another fact. When a nuclear blast takes place high in the atmosphere, it sets off an enormous electromagnetic charge. If some terrorist or rogue state were to set off even a small blast in the skies over America, it could freeze up and melt down every computer in the country in a way that would make Y2K look like a day at the beach. Tim Weiner, in his book Blank Check, about secret U.S. government programs, explained the phenomenon. A warhead exploding 300 miles above Omaha would instantly zap the United States from coast to coast with a tidal wave of charged electrons. Every electronic system, every radio transmission, every computer bank in the country would experience something like a lightning strike magnified a millionfold. An intense surge of up to 50,000 volts per meter would flow through the circuitry that wires the entire nation. The phenomenon was discovered in 1962 when the U.S. exploded 3 nuclear weapons high over the Pacific. Although the tests took place 800 miles from Hawaii, streetlights went off across Oahu and burglar alarms went haywire in Honolulu. Unlike the Y2K problems, the effects of this electromagnetic pulse, says Weiner, remain what engineers call a known unknown, a problem that is known to exist but has no known solution. There is one more way that being too connected could become problematic for us. That is, if being connected, or rather over-connected, becomes socially unbearable. Sitting in my office one day in the summer of 1999, I came across the following item on the Associated Press, Wired out of Israel. It said that an Israeli man was pulled over Monday after a policewoman nabbed him driving through the coastal town of Netanya with a mobile phone in each hand. Engrossed in his conversation, he was operating the steering wheel with his elbows. The Daily Haaretz reported, the volunteer policewoman flagged him down when she saw his gray Mitsubishi meandering from side to side. I can't think of anything that better illustrates the disease of overconnectedness than this story of an Israeli motorist with a cell phone pressed to both ears, driving his car with his elbows. This is the real, lasting Y2K virus for developed countries. It is the anxiety that is going to be produced when telecommunications combines with the Evernet, the technology that will allow people to get online from their watch, their cell phone, their car, their toaster, or their Walkman, so that everyone will be able to be connected all the time, everywhere. This virus of overconnectedness is spreading daily and has no known cure. I was in a restaurant with my daughter one day in the summer of 1999 when I found myself seated between two families, both of whose fathers were speaking loudly into cell phones as if they were in their offices. I wanted to scream, Look, I'm on vacation. I'm trying to get away from my office. I don't want to be in your office. I don't want to hear about your problems. Turn off that phone. In October 1999, I was in Chicago at the Bris, the Jewish ritual of circumcision, of my new nephew. Just before the moil, a white-bearded rabbi was about to perform the circumcision, a cell phone rang. We all looked around for who was interrupting this solemn ceremony, when the moil sheepishly put down his scalpel and pulled a cell phone out of his pocket. More and more, I find myself reacting to people with cell phones the same way I react to someone smoking a cigar at the dinner table next to me, with rage. I can't wait for the day when they have soundproof cell phone sections in restaurants. Cell phone or no cell phone? The hostess will ask before she seats you. I also can't wait for the day that Motorola comes out with a device that enables you to jam all the cell phones around you as easily as opening your garage door. Zap! No more dial tones within 50 feet. So sorry. It is not surprising that overconnectedness is becoming the disease of the Internet age, because as the Internet and globalization shrink both time and distance, it can be great for business, but it is becoming socially claustrophobic. The New Yorker once illustrated this point with a cartoon. It showed a man escorting his date back to her apartment door after dinner. She squeezes his hands and says, "I'd love to ask you in, Howard, but they start trading in Hong Kong in 10 minutes. Time and distance provide buffers and breathing space in our lives, and when you eliminate both, you eliminate some very important cushions. Several rabbis have written me that they believe and indeed hope that overconnectedness will lead to Jews learning to appreciate the Sabbath more. The idea of a day of rest when you turn off all your cell phones and just disconnect could take on a whole new appeal. A friend who works on Madison Avenue said to me that before cell phones and beepers, when someone called the office for him and he was out, his secretary would simply say, "Alan is out." Now, when someone calls and the secretary says he's out, the next thing the caller says is, "Well, connect me to his cell phone or beep him wherever he is." The presumption now is that he is always reachable, that he's never out. Out is over. Now, you're always in. And when you're always in, you're always on. And when you're always on, you're just like a computer server. You can never stop and relax. When was the last time you heard someone say, "Well, let me sleep on that"? There is no time or space to sleep on anything anymore. A Wall Street exec remarked to me that he used to love going to Japan, working all day and then hitting the great Tokyo restaurants at night. But now, with better communications, he works all day, and just when he's about to hit the Tokyo sushi bars, the faxes, beeper messages, and cell phone calls start coming in from New York. "I haven't been out to dinner in Tokyo in 5 years now," he said. "I end up working a 19-hour day now whenever I'm there." I was interviewing a senior British defense official one day when he mentioned that he had recently put his cell phone down on the X-ray machine conveyor belt at an airport and then forgot to claim it on the other side. When he realized 5 minutes later that he didn't have his phone, he rushed back and got it. The security officer at the X-ray machine told him he got 2 calls in those 5 minutes, both of which he discovered later were from other senior defense officials. "The guy could have started a war if he had said the wrong things," the British official quipped of the baggage inspector who had found his phone. I forgot to ask the British official if he was working or on his way from a holiday when he forgot his phone, but then again, he probably wouldn't have known the difference himself. When we are all connected all the time, the boundary between work and play disappears. Working moms and dads can now be home more. That's good, in theory. But what it often means is that the workday becomes 19 hours long. I have a friend who works on a high-stress senior government legal job. He told me he often comes home early and on weekends with his cell phone and tries to work at home in order to be with his teenage daughter. Even though it means that 20 minutes out of every 2 hours he is on the cell phone, he figures it is better than nothing. His daughter disagrees. She eventually got so upset with the interruptions that she finally said to him, "Dad, just stay at the office." I'm with his daughter, though I have to confess to having been as guilty as her dad at times. And it's only the beginning. The Y2K computer problem was over after a few months, but the Y2K social disease is going to be with us for a long time. To be sure, there are many virtues to being connected, from wiring your neighborhood and getting to know your neighbors better to having more flexible work hours. It's all a question of balance. If the balance tips toward overconnectedness, if people really start feeling choked by the system, they will get violent. Just too disconnected. One of the paradoxes of a world in which we are all increasingly connected is that it makes it that much easier for us all to become increasingly disconnected. Because the more we are all wired and networked together, the easier it becomes for each of us to work alone, at home, from our beach house, tree house, or from remotest Africa. The more we are all networked, the more we can all be freelancers. A friend of mine works for a large consulting firm, and recently, after a globalization-driven merger, he basically lost his office. The firm went to a system of motel desking, in which people share desks, and you have office space only when you need it. All the files have been centralized and put online, and you are expected to just download everything you need. On paper, it is all much more efficient, but as my friend remarked to me one day, it has made his job a lot less satisfying. "I have been doing legal work for a big firm for some 20 years now," he related. "Now, I am not that old, but in the old days, the 1980s, if you had a problem that you were trying to solve, you would walk down the hall to the water cooler, if there was one, and you would say, 'I have this problem with this corporation. They want to spin off these assets in this way. There are some capital gains we need to recapture. How do you think we should go about it?' And one of your colleagues would tell you that a couple of years ago we did it this way. And then someone else would walk by and say, 'Well, it wasn't exactly like that. It was more like this.' And maybe one guy there, Bill, would be the resident expert, and he would give you his sage advice. But you would work it out face to face with your colleagues in an informal way. Well, now, half of us don't even have offices. I don't even have a desk of my own anymore. We rotate desks now to save office space. There is no water cooler, and there is no Bill just down the hall because he's working at home thanks to telecommuting. I'm sure Bill has a better lifestyle now because he can work at home, and a lot of the answers he might have are now in the computer somewhere, but you have to know how to find them. What you miss, though, is Bill saying, 'Yeah, you could solve the problem this way, according to the book, but you have to watch out for this.' It's all the little intangibles you can't get from a search engine. Sure, you could email Bill at bill.com, and he would tell you the answer, but it's still just not the same." A few months after talking to my friend, I came across an ad for a business software company called Office.com, whose motto is, "More informative than a trip to the water cooler." Yeah, I thought, but probably nowhere near as satisfying. And it is not going to get any better. It is no longer just baseball and basketball players who are supposed to become free agents. Now everyone is expected to move from job to job, team to team, or company to company. In the new parlance, we are all e-lancers now. Why is this happening? Nicholas G. Carr, an editor at the Harvard Business Review, summarized it well when he wrote in the June 1999 issue, "The old industrial model of organization, big groups of people doing specialized coordination, made economic sense for most of this century in a world of walls. But it is making less and less sense today. It's too costly and too unwieldy. Letting work shuttle freely between small temporary teams that can organize and coordinate themselves in response to market stimuli is much more efficient. In the face of the new economics, it makes sense for companies to pursue ever greater levels of flexibility. But does it make sense for human beings? Carr raised this question as part of his review of a provocative book by the sociologist Richard Sennett about the downsides of this sort of flexibility and disconnectedness. The book was entitled The Corrosion of Character: The Personal Consequences of Work in the New Capitalism. As Carr noted in his review, to be flexible is to lack attachments. The flexible company must always be ready to abandon strategies, products, people, and even customers in order to move into a more lucrative market or adopt a more efficient and profitable way of doing business, as happened with my friend at his consulting firm. But forming connections and communities, holding on to one's olive trees, just being able to decorate your own desk and call it your home away from home, is one of the most defining characteristics of human beings. Globalization, by creating a world in which we are constantly being asked to break such connections, reinvent ourselves, think in the short term, and stay flexible, sets us all adrift and leaves everyone feeling like a temporary worker. Paraphrasing Sennett's argument, Carr said this leaves us all uncertain of who we are or how we should act. In the aggregate, it erodes the foundations of society. We don't bond with others, we team with them. We don't have friends, we have contacts. We're not members of enduring, nurturing communities. We're nodes in ever-shifting, coldly utilitarian networks. But every time we reinvent ourselves, we erase the meaning that our past experiences granted us. In place of an ethical sense of ourselves as people with clear attachments, we are left with an ironic sense of ourselves as fabrications. We become unreal, virtual. What is maybe most scary about all this, Sennett himself notes in his book, is that it is the result of something we call progress. He writes, "What is peculiar about uncertainty today is that it exists without any looming historical disaster. Instead, it is woven into the everyday practices of a vigorous capitalism. Instability is meant to be normal." Schumpeter's creatively destructive entrepreneur is served up as an ideal everyman. Perhaps the corroding of character is the inevitable consequence. It must be noted, of course, that the very rootless flexibility that Sennett decries, though unnerving at times, can also be liberating. And while there are now fewer walls to protect you in your current job, there are also fewer walls to keep you out of a new one. Moreover, the flexibility of this system means the penalty for failure is much lower. As Carr himself observes, "You may have messed up your last assignment, but there is a good chance that your next one will be better suited to your talents." Will we each find a floor, a desk, a shop, a website, a home we can grasp onto long enough to sink roots for our olive trees? Or are we destined now to be constantly riding the elevators up and down? How people will feel about globalization and whether they will rebel against it will depend in part on how this question is ultimately answered. Just too intrusive. In the summer of 1999, I visited Chicago and stayed at a large chain hotel. In the morning, I went down to swim in the pool, and I put my room key in my bathing suit pocket. I then proceeded to lose the key in the pool, so I went back to the front desk, dressed in my bathing suit, and asked for a new room key. "Can you show me a picture ID?" asked the desk clerk. "No," I said, "I'm in my bathing suit. I have no ID." "No problem," said the clerk. She typed a few things into her computer and then looked up at me and said, "What are the ages of your two daughters?" My daughters weren't with me. but I had stayed in this hotel a year earlier with them. I correctly answered the clerk's question about their ages, and she handed me a new key. But I was upset. I couldn't help wondering, what else do they have on me and my family and that little computer, and who are they selling that information to? A few months later, I got a letter from an old friend, Richard Day, whom I met in Beirut in 1982, but had lost contact with. Richard, a consultant, was living in Dubai, and his letter said basically the following. I found your address on a people search site on the Internet. I was amazed that for a mere $99 I could order a complete credit check on you that included, among other things, a complete listing of your assets. I kept my $99, but it made me wonder what all of this is really coming to. Your daughters and my sons can check each other out in ways that you and I never dreamed were possible. And it's just the beginning. Rule number one of the Internet age is that we are all connected, but nobody is quite in charge. That is, the Internet is Orwellian in its reach, but there's no Big Brother. What there is instead of Big Brother is a lot of little brothers. Beware of the little brothers. What the Internet does is super empower individuals, websites, corporations, and hotels, the little brothers, so they can amass huge amounts of information outside of any government supervision. Some will use it responsibly, others not. A 1999 study by the Center for Democracy and Technology found that less than 10% of all websites respected the OECD's basic privacy guidelines, which stipulate that a person has the right to expect that any personal data they submit over the Internet will not be used without their consent, that they have a right to correct any errors, and they have the right to assume that any confidential data will be protected from abuse. One of the positive aspects of globalization is that it promotes transparency in financial dealings. Both countries and companies that want to plug into the herd have to disclose things to the market that in the past they could keep hidden. But just as there is nowhere to hide for countries and companies, so there is increasingly nowhere to hide for individuals. Every phone call you make, every bill you charge, every prescription drug you buy, every video you rent, every plane ride you take, every cash machine you use, gets logged somewhere in a computer of the electronic herd, and you have no idea when it might come back to haunt you. Have an affair with the President of the United States, and a special prosecutor might one day trace every phone call you made to him and every tie you bought him on a credit card. Are you into visiting the porno website Hot Sex? Well, just remember this. When you visit many websites today, they are set up so that you automatically pick up what is known as a cookie. A cookie is an electronic fingerprint that is placed in your Internet browser by the various sites you visit. Cookies can indicate where you go, where you shop, and what you do online. When someone, say an online retailer, piles up all the cookies in your cookie jar, they can form a pretty good picture of your habits, preferences, likes, and dislikes, and then push back at you all sorts of direct marketing baked particularly for you. Not worried, you say? Think about this. In 1998, I saw a television commercial for something called Guard Dog, a software product that provides Internet security and encryption for your home computer and for your own website. The commercial shows someone peeping through the closed shutters of a window, and then a voiceover says, "The Internet is your window on the world, but it can also be a window on you." To prevent that, buy Guard Dog software. It keeps the web from surfing you. A few months later, I saw an item on ABC News that explained exactly why you might want Guard Dog. It reported the following. A national poll in the summer of 1998 found that 81% of people believe their personal information, including credit ratings, medical histories, and financial records, is insecure. The report added that states such as Texas are already putting their state criminal histories online. The Texas Criminal Record Database is searchable for $3.15 per name searched. An offshore company called Public Data, based in Anguilla, British West Indies, buys public records in bulk and puts them online in a database searchable for as little as 3 cents per search. Public Data offers a list of records, including criminal records, indexes to some counties' court records and voter registration polls, driver's license records, and so on. It gets worse. In December 1998, USA Today reported that a popular handheld computer that is designed to store dates, addresses, and reminder notes can be programmed to pick car locks by copying codes from remote-controlled keys, its manufacturer confirmed. With added software, the $369 Palm 3 can intercept an infrared car lock signal up to about 10 feet away. How we deal with all the little brothers is going to become an important political issue. There are lots of ideas. One of the most thoughtful comes from Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig in his book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. Lessig argues that people suffer from the illusion that however cyberspace is right now is how it must always be. It can't be changed. It's a place to be discovered, not shaped. But cyberspace was not handed down by God. Its architecture is shaped by people with certain interests, who are, as we speak, designing the hardware of cyberspace in ways that are determining the freedom and privacy that you and I will have there, says Lessig. The architecture of cyberspace is highly influenced by commerce and government, both of which have an interest in knowing as much as they can about what people are doing and where, says Lessig. So it's not an accident that the emerging internet architecture makes it easier to track people and collect private data, because tracking people is what governments like, and collecting private data is what commerce likes. Government, argues Lessig, can't legislate privacy on the internet because it has no way to really enforce it there. But it can create incentives for people to build privacy filters and other safeguards into the internet. Let's say the government says that data about you is your property, and the only way that someone can take it away is by negotiating with you, he said. That would create an incentive for web designers to make it easier for each of us to negotiate about our personal data, what we want to give up for free, what we want to be paid for, and what we don't want to give up at all. The right to privacy is a core value from our Constitution and Founding Fathers. Are we moving into an age when such values will only be respected on land, but not in cyberspace? Justice Louis Brandeis spoke often about the need to preserve each citizen's right to be left alone. But as the internet moves into the center of how we communicate, educate, and do business, it raises a potentially deeper problem. The right not just to be left alone, but the right to remain opaque. To not have every move you make in life recorded in a computer somewhere and available for downloading to anyone, anywhere, for $39. That is where we are heading, as the amount of personal data being piled up on all of us by little brothers in both the government and the private sector grows by leaps and bounds. Advances in computing are having a twin effect, noted The Economist, May 1, 1999. They are not only making it possible to collect information that once went largely unrecorded, but are also making it relatively easy to store, analyze, and retrieve this information in ways which, until quite recently, were impossible. And the smaller, faster, cheaper, and more interconnected computers become, the stronger become all the little brothers. If the Constitution ends where the web begins, If people experience globalization as something that intrudes into their lives and privacy, much more than it empowers them to reach out into the world, if they feel that the web is surfing them more than they are surfing the web, they will eventually erect new walls. Just too unfair for too many people. Julia Preston, the New York Times correspondent in Mexico City in the late 1990s, tells a wonderful story that captures the tension between the winners and losers from globalization in Mexico. It was May Day 1996, Preston recalled, and there was a very big demonstration in Mexico City. It was the first year after the austerity program, and so it was an exceptionally large march, including a large number of unions which had been part of the government labor alignment and had defied orders against demonstrating. I was walking in the middle of the Union of University Employees, which has a long history of left-wing activism, and they were a particularly noisy bunch. They were chanting, "Muera Ortiz," "Death to Ortiz," the finance minister. They were loud and hostile. In the middle of this demonstration, my mobile phone rings in my purse, and it is the secretary of Minister Ortiz on the phone, telling me the finance minister wants to speak with me. I said it was too noisy for me to speak from where I was standing in the middle of the demonstration, and I walked out of the crowd over to a building to get some quiet, and also to give myself some time to prepare for speaking to Ortiz. So he gets on the phone, and I said, "Mr. Minister, I have to tell you there are a large number of people here who don't agree with your economic policies." He sort of chuckled, and it quickly became clear that he wasn't interested. He was calling me to announce and celebrate the fact that Mexico had just placed its first 30-year bond. It was the first time since the 1995 peso crash they had placed a long-term bond on Wall Street without any American backing, and it had been received very well. So there he was, high as a kite, and there I was talking to him on the phone from the middle of this demonstration where people were calling for his death. Ortiz could survive such a day, and globalization can survive such a day, as long as enough people in Mexico feel they are deriving enough benefits from this system to tolerate it. They may take to the streets occasionally to denounce a policy or to make a labor demand, but those Mexican workers are not joining ranks with Sub-Commander Marcos and the Zapatista guerrillas in wanting to disconnect Mexico from the system. Not yet. In large part, this is because the electronic herd and the supermarkets, while they hammered a country such as Mexico, have also been quick to reward improved performance, buying more from Mexico and investing more in Mexico as soon as it got its economic house in order. The growth that this has produced is what has enabled the Ortizes of the world to shrug off the calls for their death and to say to the workers, "Just stick with me for a little longer, and I promise you this will all turn around." But what happens if you have a recession in the United States and Western Europe at the same time, and Japan continues in stagnation and is unable to pick up the slack? The electronic herd could get emaciated, and instead of being able to reward Mexico, Brazil, or Korea by buying their bonds when they do the right thing, when they reform their economies, and when they put on the golden straitjacket, would be unable to do much at all. Instead of America and Western Europe being able to suck in all the imports from the developing countries so they can export their way back to life, the big developed countries could be tempted to put up new protectionist walls against more imports to preserve their own shrinking job markets. Will the system continue to hold then? We don't know, because in the first decade of globalization, we really have never faced this scenario. But this is the real stress test for the globalization system, how it survives a recession at the core. And until we go through it, we really won't know whether the process of globalization is irreversible or not. Just too dehumanizing. I was driving along the Beltway in Washington one day when I heard a news story on WTOP radio that caught my ear. It reported with great fanfare that when you call a particular New York cable television company, it offers the following new option. If you want to speak to a human being, press 1. I always press 1. I will always press 1. In fact, whenever I get that message, if you don't have a touch-tone phone, stay on the line and an operator will assist you. I always stay on the line and wait to speak to the operator, even though I have a touch-tone phone. Always being able to press 1 is essential for globalization's success. Always being able to stay on the line to speak to an operator is essential for globalization's success. Because at some level, you need to feel that this system is built for human beings, not machines. Otherwise, it becomes deeply alienating. But what happens if pressing 1 is no longer an option? What happens if globalization becomes just too standardizing, too dehumanizing? My brother-in-law, Ted Century, is an inventor of medical devices with his own basement machine shop. Ted is a salt-of-the-earth kind of guy who makes incredibly sophisticated precision devices with his hands. As I talked to him one afternoon about advances in online trading, the internet, satellite technology, and the like, he nodded his head for a while and then finally said, "Yeah, but where does quality of life fit into all this stuff?" Ted and my sister Jane then launched into a story that had really been bothering them. Every year in the summer, we go from our home in Philadelphia down to South Jersey to buy local produce, particularly Jersey beefsteak tomatoes, said Ted. They are these big, juicy tomatoes bursting with flavor. There is something in the sandy soil of South Jersey about the way it retains water that is really good for growing tomatoes and sweet corn. And that's why Campbell's always got tomatoes for their tomato soup from the small farmers there. But the great thing about these tomatoes was that they didn't travel well, so no one tried to sell them to a global market. They also came in all different shapes and sizes with these ugly cracks at the top, but they tasted incredible. We used to make a special trip to the farmers' markets in South Jersey and buy them by the pound. We'd bring them home and cut them up for salads and cook them into tomato sauce. We had friends who ate so many of them at once their lips would get sore from the acid. You forget that tomatoes are a fruit, but the South Jersey beefsteak tomatoes were so sweet they tasted like a fruit. Well, in the summer of 1997, when we went to make our annual tomato buying trip, we noticed that they were harder to come by. Then in the summer of 1998, we went out there to the farmers' markets to buy some, and they were gone. Just gone. Instead, the farmers' markets had these tomatoes that were all the exact same size, with a sort of pink color and waxy taste. And at one farmers' market, this guy opened his cooler for us, and he had boxes and boxes of them neatly stacked inside. He said this new variety could be stockpiled longer and shipped farther. They all looked the same, and there were no more cracks. He said customers didn't like the cracks. They were too ugly. At this point, my sister Jane joined in. "What's worse," she said, "is that they still called these ersatz little laboratory tomatoes Jersey beefsteaks. In other words, they got rid of the tomato, but they kept the brand name, so they can sell them all over the world as Jersey beefsteaks, even though they really don't have the same look or taste." I was profoundly depressed by this whole thing. It hit me that something that was a real piece of the quality of my life was gone forever, and I'm too young to be eating plastic food for the rest of my life. I saw it as a sign of the future, all the unique things in our lives being turned into plastic. At the end of the conversation, my brother-in-law said to me, "The first thing that occurred to me after we got back from the trip, when we found out that they didn't sell our tomatoes anymore, was to get on the internet and start checking for Jersey beefsteaks to see if anyone is still growing the real thing. Someone out there must be." Ted's instinct was a good one. If there is still a market for them, and the seeds are still around, some farmer using the internet, a website, www.tomatoes.jerseybeefsteaks.com, a Federal Express account, and a Visa account, we'll surely set up a virtual farmer's market where it will be possible to order original Jersey beefsteak tomatoes from your home PC, charge them on Visa, and have them delivered by FedEx the next day. At least I hope so. The future of globalization may depend on it. How we learn to strike the right balance between globalization's inherently empowering and humanizing aspects and its inherently disempowering and dehumanizing aspects will determine whether it is reversible or irreversible, a passing phase, or a fundamental revolution in the evolution of human society. In July 1998, The New Yorker ran a cartoon that showed two long-haired, scraggly, bearded Hell's Angels types, one wearing a skull and crossbones t-shirt, and the other sitting on his motorcycle. Each is obviously asking the other how his day went. One Hell's Angel finally says to the other, "How was my day? Advancing issues led declines." And so it is with globalization. Globalization is always in the balance, always tipping this way or that. Our job as citizens of the world is to make certain that a majority of people always feel that advancing issues are leading the declines. Only then will globalization be sustainable. And no nation has a greater responsibility and opportunity to ensure this than the United States of America. Chapter 20. There is a way forward. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. John F. Kennedy. In the winter of 1996, I accompanied then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, on a trip to the war zones of Africa, where UN peacekeepers were deployed. The tour took us to the civil wars of Liberia, Angola, Rwanda, and Burundi. During the stop in Rwanda, the last on the trip, Albright asked her staff and the crew of her Air Force Boeing 737 to pose for a picture on the runway of Kigali International Airport. Her aircraft was painted white and blue, like a mini Air Force One, and was emblazoned with the words, "United States of America." Albright's staff and crew stood on the steps and beneath the wings. They included a Greek American, a Czech American, Jewish Americans, Black Americans, and White Americans. There were Air Force crewmen from small towns and State Department experts from Ivy League colleges. And they were all standing there, shoulder to shoulder. As a reporter on the trip, I didn't think I belonged in the picture, so I stood over to the side and watched the Rwandan ground crew watching the American picture-taking session. The Rwandans had a slightly quizzical look. I couldn't help wondering to myself what they were making of this scene, which represented America at its best. The spirit of community, the melting pot, the willingness to help faraway strangers in need, the freedom and opportunity for each individual to work his way to the top, and most important, a concept of citizenship based on allegiance to an idea, not a tribe. As a picture, it represented everything that Rwanda was not. Rwanda had just emerged from an orgy of tribal warfare, Rwandan Hutus against Rwandan Tutsis, in which a million people were killed, some of them brutally hacked to death with machetes. Rwanda was all olive trees and no Lexuses, a country that was all gnarled roots choking one another, and no flowering branches. As I watched that scene on the tarmac, I started to get mad, but not just about the tragedy in Africa, mad about the budget debate that was then going on in the U.S. Congress. It seemed to me then, and even more now, that we have something tremendously special in America. But if we want to preserve it, we have to pay for it. We have to nurture it. But when I listened at that time to the infamous 1994 class of freshman Republicans, I heard mean-spirited voices, voices uninterested in any compromise, voices for whom the American government was some kind of evil enemy. I heard men and women who insisted that the market alone should rule, and who thought it was enough to be right about the economic imperatives of free trade and globalization, and the rest would take care of itself. I heard lawmakers who seemed to believe America had no special responsibility for maintaining global institutions, such as the UN, the World Bank, and the IMF, which are critical for stabilizing an international system from which America benefits more than any other country. And as I thought about all this on the tarmac of Kigali Airport, I said to myself, "Well, my freshman Republican friends, come to Africa. It's a freshman Republican's paradise." Yes, sir, nobody in Liberia pays taxes. There's no gun control in Angola. There's no welfare as we know it in Burundi, and no big government to interfere in the market in Rwanda. But a lot of their people sure wish there were. Take, for instance, the desk clerk in Luanda, Angola, who looked at me as if I were nuts when I asked her if it was safe for me to take a walk 3 blocks from the hotel down the main street of the Angolan capital in the middle of the day. "No, no, no," she shook her head. "Not safe." I'll bet she wouldn't mind paying some taxes to put more police on the street. And then there was the Liberian radio reporter who approached me in Monrovia and demanded to know why the U.S. Marines came to Liberia after the Civil War broke out in 1989, evacuated only the U.S. citizens, and then left the Liberians to fight it out alone. "We all thought, 'The Marines are coming, we will be saved,'" the Liberian reporter remarked. "But then they left. How could they leave?" Poor guy. His country has no Marines to rescue him. I'll bet he wouldn't mind paying some taxes for a few good men. They don't worry about big government in Liberia. They don't worry about government at all, thanks to the gangs and warlords who have dominated that land for the past decade. No, Liberians may never again have to worry about government red tape. In fact, the only regulation I saw at the executive mansion in Liberia was a sign taped to a bullet-shattered window at the front door. It said, "Deposit your weapons here." Employers don't have to fret at all about pesky worker safety rules in Angola, let alone services for the handicapped. The 70,000 Angolans who have had limbs blown off by landmines planted during the last 25 years of civil war seem to make do just fine on their own. You can see them limping around the streets of Luanda in Fellini-esque contortions, hustling for food and using tree limbs as a substitute for the human variety. And in Rwanda and Burundi, no one was asked to pay for Head Start, unemployment insurance, Medicaid, national service, or student loan programs. Instead, they just have brutal competition for scarce land, energy, and water, with Tutsi and Hutu tribesmen taking turns downsizing each other to grab more resources for themselves. They said at the time that the freshman Republicans almost never went on congressional junkets. They thought it would look bad to their constituents back home. Most of them didn't even have passports. Too bad. They wanted all the respect and benefits that come with being the Michael Jordans of geopolitics, with being an American in today's globalization system, but without any of the sacrifices and obligations, at home or abroad, that go with it. They should come to war-torn Africa and get a real taste of what happens to countries where there is no sense of community, no sense that people owe their government anything, no sense that anyone is responsible for anyone else, and where the rich have to live behind high walls and tinted windows while the poor are left to the tender mercies of the marketplace. I don't want to live in such a country or such a world. It is not only morally wrong, it will become increasingly dangerous. designing ways to avoid that should be at the heart of American domestic and foreign policy today. Unfortunately, neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party has fully made the shift from the Cold War system to the globalization system in framing their own politics. They each behave at times as if the world is now safe for us to be both insular and mindlessly partisan on every issue. To the extent that there is any serious discussion about the shared national interest today, it's all about whether we can define a new common threat and not a new common mission. The big enemy is still the organizing principle for American internationalism, not the big opportunity, let alone the big responsibility. America does have a shared national interest to pursue in today's globalization system, one that constitutes both a big opportunity and a big responsibility. Put simply, as the country that benefits most from today's global integration, as the country whose people, products, values, technologies, and ideas are being most globalized, it is our job to make sure that globalization is sustainable. And the way we do that is by ensuring that the international system remains stable and that advances lead declines for as many people as possible, in as many countries as possible, on as many days as possible. In the Cold War system, the fundamental political question was, which hardware and operating system do you choose? In the globalization era, the fundamental political question is, how do you make the best of the only hardware and operating system that works, globally integrated free market capitalism? America can be, and should be, the world's role model in answering this question. America has had 200 years to invent, regenerate, and calibrate the balances that keep markets free without becoming monsters. We have the tools to make a difference. We have the responsibility to make a difference. And we have a huge interest in making a difference. Managing globalization is a role from which America dare not shrink. It is our overarching national interest today. And the political party that understands that first, the one that comes up with the most coherent, credible, and imaginative platform for pursuing it, is the party that will own the real bridge to the future. In order to think about how to meet this challenge, you need to start by getting rid of the political language of the Cold War system, which doesn't really capture the issues at stake, and develop new terms appropriate to the globalization system. For this purpose, I have designed a matrix, which I believe captures the four basic political identities people can choose from in the system of globalization. To find out who you are and who your rivals are in this new era, consider this matrix. The line across the middle from left to right is the globalization line. The first thing you have to do is locate yourself on this line in accordance with how you feel about globalization. At the far right end of this line are the integrationists. These are the people who really welcome globalization because they think it is either good or inevitable and want to see it promoted through more free trade, more internet commerce, more networking of schools, communities, and business, more electronic mail, so that we can ultimately have global integration 24 hours a day across 24 time zones and into cyberspace. At the far left end of this globalization line are the separatists. These are people who believe that free trade and technological integration are neither good nor inevitable, because they widen income gaps, lead to jobs being sent abroad, homogenize culture into some global mush, and lead to life being controlled by These are people who believe that free trade and technological integration are neither good nor inevitable, because they widen income gaps, lead to jobs being sent abroad, homogenize culture into some global mush, and lead to life being controlled by distant, faceless market forces. They want to see globalization stopped in its tracks. They want to cut it off and kill it now. So, the first thing you have to do is locate yourself somewhere on this line. Are you a separatist, an integrationist, or something in between? Now, look at the line running from top to bottom of the matrix. This is the distribution axis. It represents what sort of policies you believe governments should adopt to go along with globalization and the golden straitjacket. At the lower end of this line are the social safety netters. I define social safety netters as those people who believe that globalization will only be sustainable if it is democratized, in both the economic and the political sense. Economically, this means designing trampolines and social safety nets that don't simply try to cushion the fall of the left behinds, no-knots, and turtles, but actually try to bring them into the system by helping them acquire the tools and resources to compete. And politically, it means encouraging democratization in developing countries that are globalizing, because there is no sustainable economic growth without the growth of personal freedoms as well. Obviously, not everyone agrees with this approach. That's why at the top of this distribution line, that is at the other end from the social safety netters, are the let-them-eat-cakers. These are people who believe that globalization is essentially winner-take-all, loser-take-care-of-yourself. They want to shrink government, taxes, and safety nets, and let people truly reap the fruits of their own labor or pay the price of their own ineptitude. There is nothing that focuses the mind more on getting a job and keeping it, say the let-them-eat-cakers, than knowing that there is no net under you. So, next you have to locate yourself on this distribution axis. Are you a social safety netter? Are you a let-them-eat-caker? Or are you somewhere in between? All the key players in American politics today can be better understood and identified by this matrix than by the old labels of Democrat, Republican, and Independent. Bill Clinton is an integrationist social safety netter. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich was an integrationist let-them-eat-caker. That's why Clinton and Gingrich were always allies on free trade, but opponents on Social Security welfare spending. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt is a separatist social safety netter, and Ross Perot is a separatist let-them-eat-caker. That's why Gephardt and Perot were allies against NAFTA and more free trade, but opponents on Social Security welfare spending, where Gephardt wants to spend money on social safety net programs and to defend workers' rights, not just enhance their capabilities. While I use this matrix to describe America today, you can easily adapt it to any country. Simply put yourself in this matrix and find out who you are and who your enemies will be in the next great political debate. I am an integrationist social safety netter. What does it mean to be an integrationist social safety netter? It means articulating a politics of sustainable globalization, a geopolitics of sustainable globalization, a foreign and defense policy, a geoeconomics of sustainable globalization, and finally an ethics of sustainable globalization. A way of thinking about where values, parenting, and God fit into this system. In other words, it means articulating a new vision for a new international system. Politics for the Age of Globalization. Let's start with a politics of sustainable globalization. It has to consist of two things. One is a picture of the world, so people understand where they are. And the other is a set of integrationist social safety net policies for dealing with it. You need a picture of the world because no policy is sustainable without a public that broadly understands why it's necessary and sees the world the way you do. And politicians beware, For a lot of reasons, it is very easy to distort and demonize globalization and end up where, even if you are right on the economics, you lose control of the politics, so it works against you instead of for you. Why is this the case? Because people who are the biggest losers from globalization, workers who have lost their jobs to robots or foreign sweatshops, know exactly who they are. This makes them very easy to mobilize against more integration, technology, or free trade. People who are beneficiaries of globalization, of more open trade, and of foreign investment, often don't have a clue who they are. They often don't make the connections between globalization and their rising standards of living, and therefore they are difficult to mobilize. Have you ever heard a worker in a microchip factory say, "Boy, am I lucky. Thanks to globalization, soaring demand for American high-tech exports, the labor shortage for skilled workers in this country, and rising expectations in the developing world, my boss had to give me a raise. Ain't NAFTA wonderful?" Another reason globalization is easy to distort is that people don't understand that it is largely a technology-driven phenomenon, not a trade-driven one. We had a receptionist at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, but the company eliminated her job. She didn't lose her job to a Mexican. She lost it to a microchip, the microchip that operates the voicemail device in all our office phones. The fact is, that microchip would have taken away her job if we had no trade with Mexico. That microchip would have taken away her job had we had a 30-foot-high wall stretching from one end of the Mexican-American border to the other. But politicians don't want to acknowledge this. None of them is going to stand up and say, "I want you to get up now, unplug your phone, go to your window, throw your phone out, and shout, 'I'm not going to take it anymore. Save American jobs. Ban voicemail. Potato chips, yes. Microchips, no.'" That's not a winning political message. It's much easier instead to rail against Mexicans and foreign factories, because foreign workers and factories are easy to see, and microchips are not. They loom much larger in our consciousness as the problem. That's why trade, which is tangible, has come to symbolize for many people all the anxieties associated with rapid change and globalization, even though the main causes of those anxieties are new technologies and deregulation. Bill Clinton defeated both George Bush and Bob Dole because a majority of American voters intuitively sensed that they were in a new era, and that Clinton grasped this and had some credible ideas of how to deal with it, while Dole and Bush didn't get it at all. Unfortunately, once in office, Clinton never fully developed that intuitive sense and made it explicit, with a real picture of the world that could be repeated over and over again. It started from his first week on the job, when he defined America's central problem as affordable health care, not sustainable globalization. What should Mr. Clinton have said at his first inaugural? Something like this: "My fellow Americans, my tenure as your president is coinciding with the end of the Cold War system and the rise of globalization. Globalization is to the 1990s and the next millennium what the Cold War was to the 1950s through the 1980s. If the Cold War system was built around the threat and challenge of the Soviet Union, which was dividing the world, the globalization system is built around the threat and challenge of rapid technological change and economic integration that are uniting the world. But as it unites the world, globalization is also transforming everyone's workplace, job, market, and community, rapidly destroying old jobs and harvesting new ones, rapidly eliminating old lifestyles and producing new ones, rapidly eliminating old markets and multiplying new ones, rapidly destroying old industries and inventing new ones. Foreign trade, which represented just 13% of gross domestic product in 1970, is now up to nearly 30% of American GDP, and rising. Technological change is now so fast that American computer companies manufacture 3 different models of each computer every year. Not only is this a new world, it is for the most part a better one. Even if they have to struggle at times with this system, China, Indonesia, Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, Brazil, Argentina have seen their standards of living rise faster for more of their citizens than at any time in their history, thanks to the increasing effectiveness of financial markets in facilitating trade and investment by people in one country into the factories of another. Globalization has been the engine of unprecedented economic growth, and we must never lose sight of that. Indeed, as Treasury Secretary Larry Summers points out, thanks in large part to increasing globalization, more than 1/4 of humanity is now enjoying growth at rates in which their living standards will quadruple within a generation. Quadruple. And far from coming at the expense of the United States, this worldwide growth has led to the lowest unemployment rate in America in nearly 50 years. But globalization also presents an unprecedented challenge. While it is the engine of greater long-term prosperity for every country that plugs into the globalization system, it is also the engine of greater dislocations in the short run. And it is not enough to tell a factory worker who has suddenly lost his job to a lower-wage factory abroad that, while unfortunate, our society as a whole is better off because it can now purchase the steel or tennis shoes he once made at a cheaper price. It is not enough to tell the office worker whose job has been phased out because of the installation of a new computer system that, while unfortunate, our society as a whole is better off because it will be much more productive with that new network system installed. The benefits of globalization tend to be measured in the long run and for society as a whole, but the dislocations come immediately and for specific individuals who know they have been hurt. Therefore, given this mismatch between the long-term opportunities and growth that globalization presents for greater well-being, and its disruptive political, environmental, and social impacts, the United States needs a broad strategy to make globalization sustainable, to get the best out of it while softening the worst. Think of the world as a wheel with spokes. At the hub of this wheel is what I would label globalization and rapid economic and technological change. That is, in plain language, the one big thing that is going on out there. Because it is at the center, we need a different approach to healthcare, welfare, education, job training, the environment, market regulation, social security, campaign finance, and expansion of free trade. Each one of these areas has to be adjusted, adapted, or reformed to enable us as a society to get the most out of this globalization system and to cushion its worst aspects. Globalization demands that our society move faster, work smarter, and take more risks than at any time in our history. As your president, I make you 2 promises. One is that I will make it my business to equip each of you and our society at large to meet this challenge with the right combination of integrationist programs and social safety nets. The other is that I will be a tireless defender of our trade laws to ensure that globalization, while it challenges the American worker, does not allow others to take advantage of our openness by dumping their products here while limiting our access to their markets. I'm not here to tell you this is all going to be easy. In fact, I'm here to tell you that it is going to be really hard. But if we can strike the right balance, and I think we can, we can be the vanguard for the world on how to manage integration in the age of globalization, just as we were the vanguard for the world on how to manage containment in the age of the Cold War. God bless America. This is what Clinton believed, but it is not what he always said. And one reason his health care proposals got chewed apart by his opponents, not the only reason, but one reason, was that they were not effectively located in a clear and constantly repeated picture of the world, with globalization at the center and the requisite policies flowing from it. As a result, notes Harvard University economist Danny Roderick, the connections and complementarities in all these areas got lost in the public debate, and it made it much easier for ideologues and extremists, as well as economic populists, nationalists, know-nothings, nativist xenophobes, and opportunists, to often skew the debate on any one issue, like trade or healthcare reform, and drive it into a dead end. If we don't educate the public about the real nature of the world today and demystify globalization, the separatists will always exploit this confusion for their own ends. In 1998, President Clinton could not get NAFTA expanded to Chile because a union-led minority who believed that they were not benefiting from more free trade were very active in opposing the expansion of NAFTA, while the majority that was benefiting from expanded free trade never understood who they were, and therefore never got mobilized to defend their interests. A politics of sustainable globalization, though, needs more than just the correct picture of what is happening in the world. It also needs the right balance of policies. Specifically, it demands a new social bargain between workers, financiers, and governments that will make for sustainable globalization. Give them their due, the Thatcherites and Reaganites helped to prepare their countries for this era of globalization and were instrumental in bringing it about by offering an unadulterated free market vision for globalization. Their view was, let the market rule everywhere as much as possible and things will all be okay. But a pure market vision alone is not enough. It is too brutal and therefore politically unsustainable. The left, meanwhile, or what's left of the left, has tried to hold on to the paternalism of the welfare state as much as possible. This is not economically sustainable. What is needed instead of either of these extremes is a new social compact that both embraces free markets, but also ensures that they benefit and are tolerable for as many people as possible. You stabilize globalization by democratizing globalization, by making it work for more and more people all the time. Finding the appropriate social bargain to democratize globalization has been the task of the center-left, the Bill Clintons in America, and the Tony Blairs in England. Many people call this approach the third way. I don't buy that. The new social bargain that Clinton and Blair have been groping for, which is what I call integrationist social safety netism, is actually the only way for a country to thrive and survive in this new system. There is no third way. There is only one way, this balanced way. We integrationist social safety netters believe that you dare not be a globalizer in this world, an advocate of free and unfettered trade, open borders, deregulation, and internet for all, without also being a social democrat. Because if you are not willing to spend what it takes to equip the have-nots, know-nots, and turtles in your society to survive in this new system, they will eventually produce a backlash that will choke off your country from the world. You will not be able to maintain the political consensus you need for openness. At the same time, we believe you dare not be a social democrat or safety netter today without being a globalizer. Because without integration with the world, you will never generate the incomes you need to keep the standards of living rising and to take care of the left behinds. The question we all now face is, where is the appropriate equilibrium point between integrationism and social safety nets in today's globalization system? There are three elements we have to balance: the trapeze, the trampoline, and the safety net. The trapeze. First, we want as open and growing a free market-oriented economy as possible, in which people are encouraged to swing free and take crazy leaps. Without risk takers and venture capitalists, there is no entrepreneurship, and without entrepreneurship, there is no growth. Therefore, at the heart of every healthy economy are the free-swinging trapeze of free markets, because there is no better safety net than a healthy economy with low unemployment. In the growing, increasingly globalized United States economy, the unemployment rate for those with less than a high school education declined from 10.75% in 1994 to 6.75% by 1999, enabling large numbers of young people, particularly minorities, to find employment, learn skills, and gain the dignity that comes from holding a job. Yes, not everybody has a great job. Some people are flipping hamburgers, and others are designing web pages. But a job, any job, is the beginning of self-respect and stability in a person's life. Whenever I think about this issue, I always recall a story that Russian journalist Alexei Pushkov told me back in April 1995 about one of his neighbors in Moscow. He was this poor driver who lived in the apartment off the entryway. Every Friday night he would get drunk and sing along over and over in a very loud voice to two English language songs, Happy Nation and All She Wants Is Another Baby. He had no idea what the words meant. When he got really drunk, he'd start beating his wife and she would start screaming. He was driving us crazy. I wanted to throw a grenade at him. Anyway, about 8 months ago, I don't know how, he got a share in a small car repair shop. Since then, no more Happy Nation, no more singing all night, no more beating his wife. He leaves every morning at 8:30 for work, and he is satisfied. He knows he has some prospects in life now. My wife said to me the other day, "Hey, look at Happy Nation. That's what we call him. He's an owner now." This is why a trapeze strategy doesn't just mean government getting out of the way and letting the free markets rip. It also means thinking about how government can make more people owners and successful free marketers. In America, that means initiatives that will improve access to investment capital in the most distressed, low-income communities, so we are not just training people for jobs that are not available. American inner cities are emerging markets every bit as much as Bangladesh, and they sometimes need some of the same sort of market-oriented assistance programs. As Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has pointed out, the world over, private financial markets fail when it comes to the very poor. Mainstream banks do not seek out poor communities because that's not where the money is. Other barriers tend artificially to restrict the flow of capital to certain neighborhoods or minority groups, creating clear market failures. Yet if you deprive the people of these districts of the chance to lend or save, they are a good deal more likely to stay that way. One way to begin to democratize access to capital in America is to revitalize the Community Reinvestment Act, which uses government pressure to encourage commercial banks to make affordable credit to distressed neighborhoods. But there are some loans commercial banks will never make. That is why I would